thanks for showing up. I think we're ready to go ahead and get started. And I'll ask Jim if he'll go ahead and assume the chair's responsibilities this morning.
Good morning. I want to apologize for the fact that there was a party at the Palm last night that all of you missed for this new television program called K Street. I know that maybe Nick was there last night, we understand.
Jim, could you speak up a little?
Sure, I'd be glad to, sorry. This morning, we're going to focus on the partisan dimension, working with your party, working with the other party. And it's been an interesting situation with respect to partisanship. Some of you worked in a situation where there was an overwhelming number of Democrats, especially in the House of Representatives, and in the Senate, you had unified party government. The first 2 years of the Clinton administration, you had unified party government, and according to the Congressional Quarterly Weekly Report that calculates presidential support scores, and I know some of you question whether they're a good measure or not, he had an 83% batting average. The last 6 years, it dropped into the mid-30s up and down in terms of how they calculate this. It makes a difference. The environment on the Hill has changed significantly since certainly the mid-70s in terms of partisan dimensions. One is the permanent campaign. The permanent campaign is the idea that you use wedge issues on the Hill to help elect just a few more members in order to get just a little bit more of a majority. And that is very important to both parties over the last two administrations because we have partisan parity, basically, in the Senate, almost in the House on very large votes. You were there, all of you, working with unified party government and divided party government. Last night, a couple of you said, well, sometimes it's easier to work when the opposition party is in the lead. They have the majority. I'd like to start out with Chuck on that point. Is it easier to work with unified party government or divided party government? And how do you work with the leadership when the opposition party is in the majority?
I think my answer, I've thought about it a little bit, and I think we have a couple of the other participants here are sort of queued up to contribute too, but
right.
I mean, I think the my answer is sort of, it depends. And the more I thought about it, and again, I've got some Hill experience working with the president of the other party, and then presidential experience working with the other party. I think the most important thing from the president's perspective of getting things done is that you want to work with a stable majority. Yours or the others doesn't, I think it really doesn't matter. But people that you can work with who are going to deal with the issues on the basis of sort of public policy, not, as you said, the permanent election and the next election. If you're dealing, and as we were, John, Larry, and I, most of our time, I believe all of it probably was with the Senate and the House being controlled by the Republicans, if you worked with them to get things done frequently, and this is sort of more John's watch than mine, you were considered, you know, almost a traitor on your side. I mean, how can you do welfare reform? How can you do a budget proposal? Yes. But those are important to the president, and you've got a certain time period. The clock is ticking. You all know it. You know, you may not even get the second term. So you see, you're going to get things done. Now, if you're dealing with the stable majority of the other side in your party, and this is more reflective of some of my, I think, my Republican colleagues around the table, Democrats on the Hill dealing with the Republican administration before Newt, it didn't matter. You know, I mean, okay, well, we've got to deal with the chairman. This is what we're doing. This is how we're going to get done. And it's unfortunate, but we've got to move. And I think that minority was more part of the compliant than the minority that just out of power wants to get back. If we pick up 6 seats, we'll get there. Come on, let's pull together. And then at that point, that party is asking you to sacrifice the president's goal of accomplishments for their being in power and their being able to contribute down the road. So, not an economist, but I can waffle and say it depends on what sort of majority you've got, more so than the partisan composition.
John, would you like to add to this?
Maybe I'll just try to set a little bit of context and say that it absolutely depends. And I think the Clinton presidency was an interesting one because there were several phases of it. I sort of came in the middle, which I think was the anomalous piece of it, where you had a Democratic president working in one instance with a Republican majority, and where in 96 the Democrats were somewhat irrelevant in the Congress, and then an era of bipartisanship after the presidential win by Clinton in 97 as we got the balanced budget agreement done. So sort of this middle period was, I think, the anomaly, because if you look back at the bookends, which on the first part with the early part of the Clinton presidency, where even though we had the majority, we had the president and we had the majorities, it was bitterly partisan and very, very difficult in terms of the legislation, particularly if you think about the two pieces of legislation, which was the large budget act that Clinton brought forward in his first year, which passed, as you recall, on straight line party vote and by one vote and a tie break in the Senate. But it was bitterly partisan. And then, of course, the meltdown called health care reform, which was bitterly partisan also. So that was sort of the front end. I, in a sense, was fortunate enough to come in the middle in this anomalous period of working together, but each year had its own characteristics. And then finally, Larry and Chuck, at the other bookend of the administration, was again largely partisan because of the circumstances surrounding the impeachment and some other issues. What I'm going to say about my 2 years was, I feel fortunate that they were the years where the dynamics, nothing to do with me, certainly, but that the dynamics were moving in place to actually work in a fashion that could get some legislation done. So to speak to those just very, very briefly, and we can come back to the things we want, but 96 was a very, very interesting year, and the background of that, let's all recall, was 94, when the Republicans took both the House and the Senate, and then followed by 95, where under the House leadership, I think, in a very, very aggressive legislative agenda, which was, fairly characterized as somewhat overreaching, leading to the government shutdowns of 1995, that was sort of the context in which we came into the election year, one in which the Republicans had the majority, but had not used their first sort of chance at that majority in a productive way from the viewpoint of legislation or accomplishment. And then really the seminal event was the government shutdown, which leading into 96, I think it's fair to characterize that the Republican congressional majority was very interested in getting something done to show that they could govern at a time in which President Clinton was very interested in getting something done to show that he could govern and have something to run on and, frankly, to move himself more to the mainstream, embodied mostly in the Welfare Reform Act. And so we had a very interesting situation in an election year where we had a Republican majority in Congress interested in working with the Democratic president, both for their particular goals. A sidelight of that was also absolutely fascinating was the fact that the Republican presidential candidate, Bob Dole, had for a period after he won the nomination thought he could run his presidential campaign out of the United States Senate, which he quickly learned simply could not be done. Schedule, rather contrived votes that could be termed embarrassing, could be put forward at a moment's notice. And so he decided that it was time for him to actually get out of the Senate, relinquish his leadership post, and go run for president. What happened then, of course, was that Trent Lott came in as leader, and him being interested for his own reasons in showing that he could govern as a leader of the Senate Republicans, he was very interested in getting some legislation done as well. And so you had this dynamic in election year of all things, in which you have a president interested in working with Republicans to position himself toward the mainstream in terms of legislation. You have the House Republicans having been sort of, I don't know the polite word, but having stepped on it a little bit in 95 with the government shutdown, interested in doing something legislatively. And you have a new Senate Republican leader also pointed that way. And so it's sort of no surprise that in this election year, again, entirely anomalous with the other parts of the Clinton years, but you have all these forces coming together to produce the welfare reform bill, the Kennedy-Kassebaum health bill, and some small business legislation that, you know, small business does not tend to be a partisan issue anyway. And then, of course, you have on the Senate side, basically, you know, going along saying we understand, you know, the typical splits over welfare reform that you see between liberal and conservative among all parties. And then you have basically, I think the interesting partisan dimension is sort of the left out people of 96 were the House Democrats of the party of the president. And so it was a very interesting and anomalous year and led to sort of a convolution of the normal party politics that you would sort of think at first blush. And then again, just to finish on 97, it was almost serendipitous because after the major Clinton victory, and then basically the House Republican leadership, I'll never forget it, Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich came in and said, you know, there's a time to fight and there's a time to do something together. We're going to bury the axes for this year and see if we can balance the budget, because they wanted to validate that. That had been a longtime theme of the contract with America. And also the deficit numbers, because the economy were improving so radically that it was possible without tax increases to actually balance the budget. And so that set forth the dynamic of an ability to work together on what I would call would be a bipartisan basis, where finally when the bill was done, and we can come back and revisit this, but just to stick to the party politics of this, 97 was a bipartisan year because the major piece of legislation, the Budget Act, passed with an 80% vote in the Senate and a 75% majority in the House, including 75% of Democrats. And so there was a year, again, very anomalous, and the last one I can remember, of true bipartisanship during the Clinton years. And so sort of with that context, I'll stop, and you know, I think Chuck and Larry can come back to how sort of things went after that.
I think Fred,
I have a little bit to that. I've taken the view, perhaps wrongfully, but the view that when presidents or individuals are campaigning for Congress, but presidents individuals are campaigning for the presidency or people are running for re-election to the presidency. I remember Bush, 41, you know, going around the country saying, "Give me a Congress that I can work with," meaning elect, give me a Republican Congress. You know, and I sort of took the view of be careful what you ask for because you might get it. Or another question, which is, are you really sure that's what you want? There were some challenges I know that Frank and the guys with President Carter faced when they sort of came to town and had a Congress of the same political persuasion as they were, which was the same case that you guys faced with President Clinton. And, you know, which sort of goes back to how this office was created in the first place, because were it not for sort of that 53 round of the mid-year elections with President Eisenhower, and finally it's like, oh my God, they're of a different political persuasion than we are, we sort of wouldn't have the jobs, perhaps, that we would have the privilege of holding. Needless to say, we got into this a little bit yesterday on the partisan side of it, with the fact that we had to sort of govern by veto on the Bush years, save and except some of those issues where we did engage in some sort of bipartisan effort, clean air, Americans with disabilities, those kinds of things where you could probably, or getting rid and no longer dealing with Nicaragua funding anymore and getting that one off the table, for example, which had been a big issue during the Reagan days. And so when you could find those areas where you could grasp the excitement level of people of the opposite party, even when you were dealing with a Congress that was different from the presidency, it it could occur, but it was not, you were going to be picked on by somebody. In other words, Republicans were always angry that, you know, we went too far on this with clean air because you're getting too close to so-and-so on the other side. So there's a lot of hand-holding that goes into that process. I sort of am of the view that probably some of the best years for governing, frankly, occurred during the first couple of years of the Reagan administration, when you had a Senate that was of one political party, because it had changed for the first time in 26 years, a House that was getting pretty close to evenly divided. There were about 190 Republicans during that time frame of the 435, and then you kind of had this crew of 60 or 70 or so conservative Democrats, most of whom from the South, and sort of the Midwest, where you could sort of put together voting blocks or coalitions that would allow you to get across party lines in a situation like that. Ergo, Graham, Rudman, Hollings, blah, 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 and those things associated with the early budget activity back in the early 80s. And even though the House leadership, you know, sort of would be pushing in one direction, the president had an opportunity because he had Republicans in the leadership on the Senate. Could actually propose stuff that had a reasonable chance of getting down the road as opposed to something that was going to be immediately bottled up because it was an anathema to the other party. So I think those combinations and dynamics, when you take out election years, either put you in a situation where you're veto governing, as we did for 4 years, or you have the opportunity to get something done, the window you talked about, John, or the window that President Reagan had early on in the 1980s.
You know, all of you have worked with the leadership in the House and the Senate in one way or another, and you've mentioned that the president's time is a very valuable thing. I'd like you to comment on how presidents that you worked for worked with the leadership. I know that Larry was talking about in a budget agreement that Clinton and the leadership, both sides, sat in the White House and went through the budget in some detail and came out with a budget deal that eventually passed. I believe that we chatted about that last night. Did that happen very often on major bills with you? And could you share with us some experiences when the leaders from both sides were brought into the White House, and how did you work that?
I should correct one thing.
Yes.
We never let him too close to the action. Okay.
Maybe this
he was extremely well informed about it on his own and on the reading that he did, and we briefed him regularly, but I think it's important to know that, and I suspect that this would be the case with most presidents. You don't want them negotiating directly. I mean, I would think that he's a representative, they'll give away the store, you know, so you have to kind of. But go ahead.
Do you all agree with that?
But I think what you're referring to, the comment from me last night at dinner, is that the last budget agreement, we were talking about the president as a lame duck, and I asserted that it never really felt like being a lame duck. I mean, partly after having gone through impeachment. You know, lame duck? What's that?
It was a dead duck, maybe.
but again, final appropriations hadn't been passed. I think it was December, let's say, 15th. The bipartisan, bicameral leadership from the Hill was down in the Oval Office, had been there two or three times, and finally, you know, wrapped it up. Here's where we are, and we left it, and everyone then got changed in their tuxes, and we went to the, you know, the White House Congressional Ball. So they were there, but I think that was really the unusual.
It's an anomaly, but Max,
at least in our experience, it was.
Well, President Ford, for example, he had been a member of the Appropriations Committee for 25, 30 years, and when he became president, whenever the budget issues were discussed, he was in the middle of it. And I remember him giving briefings to members of the House and Senate using a blackboard on the details of the budget.
The president
himself, he knew more about it than anybody in OMB. He knew more about it than anybody on the Congressional Relations staff, and he knew more about it than the committee chairman, because he was an expert on it. And it made it very, very easy for us, because we had a president that was so involved. And then when the bill came up, he would personally lobby on it, and if anybody disputed any of the items, he was able to debate with them or converse with them over the details of it. So there was a hands-on situation with him. I never saw that in, of course, Nixon or Reagan, unless it was some issue that they were just tremendously interested in. But it was a marvel to see Ford operate in that capacity.
Yes. Frank, how did Mr. Carter, President Carter, and you work with the leadership?
Well, the same as everybody else. We had a Tuesday morning meeting with the leadership, which was essentially useless. We would brief the speaker's staff what they were going to say and what we were going to say, and so it was all sort of scripted. But it was useful. I should not say it was useless. It was useful for the president to reemphasize his priorities. There were 15 bills up there working. I really want to get this one and this one. And if to get it out of the House, Senator Byrd or Mr. Leader, can you guys take it up, you know, pretty soon? Well, I'll have to check with my guys, you know. But I think, the biggest value in those things, and I bet you I can see heads nodding around the table when I say this, is the standing around drinking coffee before the meeting, the little side conversations after the meeting, walk back to the Oval Office, so I'd like to have a word with you on the colonnade, and riding back to the Hill, putting your guys in the cars with the leadership, sort of a debrief, mm-hmm. either using the White House cars or their cars. And well, what do you think? So what do you think about it? So what Jim Wright said and so forth, and then you could really figure it out. So they were useful in that regard. As far as negotiation, I've seen President Carter, I mean, we used to negotiate with him, Stu and myself and whoever's OMB, you know, over bills and stuff. But in the energy bill, he did some negotiation with the Republicans on gas in the cabinet room, and you know, really got down to the, and it worked. Another time, this is a funny story, it's not so serious, it's Alaska Land, Jack Ferguson, who was Senator Stevens' AA, you all know Jack, called me and said, we want one last meeting. I said, when can you get us in? I said, we'll get you in tomorrow. He said, God, it's going to be tough. I said, why? He said, we're in Alaska. But they got back for it, and got in, and Senator Stevens came in, he said, what I want you to do is, there's one little creek that runs into this little river, and said, we want you to leave that out of the wilderness. And Carter got a map, President Carter got a map, and put it down on the floor of the Oval Office and got on his hands and knees. And Ted Stevens got on his hands and knees. And he said, no, you're wrong. He said, it does not run into that. This is a different watershed. It comes and it divides and goes this way. So y'all can ask Jack Ferguson this. So Jack told me, he said, they got in the car going back to the Hill, and Jack said, Ted Stevens said, it's no use, he knows more about it than we do. He knows more about Alaska than I do. But that's a funny example. You ask Jack about it the next time you see him. But he did know an awful lot of details. But the thing we talked about, well, you mentioned it, Chuck, and that, you know, of course it's right in policy, but it's not going to fly on the Hill. And President Carter was always very good, but not saying, please explain to me, you know, politics 101, why it won't work. He didn't say, this won't work. He'd take your word for it. You didn't have to explain up and down and back and forth. But he never negotiated except in broad outlines. You know.
And Will, what was your experience with President Reagan and the leaders in House and the Senate?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm trying to think of a joint congressional leadership meeting that he might have enjoyed, and there is not one that occurs to me.
Somebody brought in a good joke.
But there were after the meeting, there was a good time to tell stories, and he relished, he and Alan Simpson would engage in a repartee. But I think, you know, his Senate Republican leaders were Howard Baker, Bob Dole, and Bob Michael in the House, and they found it really, I think, far more important for them to come down to a leadership meeting, either a Republican leadership meeting or a joint meeting, and then use the words of the president and the emphasis of the president to go back to the conference and say, unity is important on this issue because the president has said, and there's no substitute for the leadership going back to the Hill, fresh from a meeting with the president and emphasizing what the priorities are, what the issue of the day is. We can say it 100 times, cabinet officers can say it 100 times, and it's just not the same. And the leaders know that it's a lot tougher to tell a president, no, I can't do this, than to tell one another or to tell one of us. So
that leads go ahead. That leads into a related question about party discipline. And we talked a little bit about your working relationships with the leadership, but I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what you attempted to do, if anything, to enforce some kind of sense of discipline within the president's party on the Hill, whether it's a majority or a minority. Larry, I see chuckling.
Well, you know, that follows somewhat from some of the things that I did want to. In discipline in our in my years was a word we didn't use.
Discipline.
That's just a standard too. The bar gets way too high.
Way too high. But I've got to say, I think just going back to the sort of the starting point of the discussion, it's useful to know that there's an inherent tension between presidents of one, you know, presidents and the legislative side on their own party. I mean, it's a fundamental tension. It's obviously built into the Constitution, but it's deeper than that. And we had hit on pettiness yesterday. It's a theme that I think is important. We ought to recur to it. Look, there is a lot of ego that gets pushed the wrong way when the only people who get on the weekend shows and the only people who are quoted are the cabinet secretaries and the chief of staff and then a lot of the congressional leadership who actually during times of divided government get more noticed by the press because it's necessary to have both sides. So along with the inherent tension of a president who typically wants his way and a Congress that doesn't always see it that way, you have a kind of sub-tier that deals with the basic human facts of politicians that needs to be understood. I would observe that, you know, take the current circumstance. Bush probably never did so well as he did last year. I think his numbers were in 65, 67. Well, that was for a lot of reasons. But he had the advantage of divided government and Democrats to blame. He was very fortunate in that regard. I think you can see what happens to him this year. I noted this morning that he's down to 52. He's got his party's in power, and there's no one to blame but his party. So that's something. I mean, what John described is the other side of that, and that is that there are times when all the stars align, and when you have divided government, you have the and that can happen very frequently when you have divided government, and we even have a word for it. It's called triangulation, which is a thing that it's thrown around now in both parties. To me, it's a fact of life. The Washington Post didn't need to coin the word or put Dickie Morris on the front page. It's there. It is a function of the institutions of our government. But talking about, when you talk about discipline within that context, you at least have an understanding of all the different forces that are involved. It is extremely difficult to marshal any kind of discipline. I'd like to follow up the story John began with. I mean, after the successes of 96 and 97, we then got impeachment. We had the triangulation charges that were out there. We had a Democratic House especially, but some in the Senate as well, who did not want accomplishments, quite the reverse. They felt that Clinton's fate was in their hands. They didn't want things to pass. They thought that they had protected him. You had Republicans who didn't want things to pass because they wanted to bring him down. So that explains the numbers you began with early on, 36% or whatever. I'm surprised we were that high. But, you know, very frequently, it's extraordinarily difficult to exercise real discipline. My guess is Reagan could do it in his first few years. I don't know whether President Carter ever felt he was able to do it. I certainly never, either when I was in the leadership in the Senate or when I was at the White House, never felt that President Clinton had the ability to exercise, quote, discipline. He had the ability to cajole. He had the various powers of the White House that he could use, but discipline was a bridge too far.
Nice.
Well, I worked for a number of administrations that were not bashful about employing discipline. I remember cases where we would have Atwater or Ed Rollins call the county chairman or the state chairman in a state where we had a congressman or senator that wasn't voting the right way and remind them of their responsibility to support the Republican administration, and we would do it in a, I think they went across the line a few times, but it was a situation where you really needed the votes. You could bring a hammer, you could hammer them a little on President wouldn't show up in that state next year for a fundraiser, or he wouldn't campaign in that state. If it was an off year, that would make an impression on him because the president would be limited in the number of states he would be able to get to. You could talk about, you could call the campaign committee and threaten them to cut off, reduce their amount of funds they might get for the campaign. You could talk to the leadership, Bob Michael or Bob Dole, and have them lean on him a little. I've heard stories about looking up IRS IRS records. You know, that was hardball back there, and especially in the Nixon administrations. But we were a little more gentle into Ford and Reagan, I believe. But when you had, we had a political office. I don't know whether President Clinton or President Carter or President Bush now has a political office, but they were very sensitive to the votes on the Hill, and if we had a real problem, Senator or Congressman, they weren't reluctant to get in there and use some force.
Frank.
I'll show you the other extreme, and it touches on a couple of points. One point is transition. When we came to town, the Democrats had to learn that they had, for all of the Nixon administration, all of the Ford administration, Carter was the first Democrat elected since Johnson, is that right? They were accustomed, they being the Democrats, Democratic leadership and rank and file, and getting up every morning and bashing the White House, saying the most horrible things they could. It's true. And he'd do anything to get on Meet the Press, unless Aspen was cranking out those Sunday press releases every night. You know?
Right.
And I've forgotten what the numbers were in the House. It was overwhelming, you know, 262 or 270 or something like that. But I think every Democratic member, with the exception of four, and those were in Georgia, had run ahead of President Carter in the general. So these guys are looking, and women, and saying, you know, I'm more popular in my district than he is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of difficult to impose discipline there. Plus, you didn't have a traditional Democratic Party, you know, nominee who came up through the ranks. So it was very difficult in that regard.
I think that's an important point. That really is. Think back, I can't think of a recent president, other guy, I guess President Bush, who's a Washingtonian. You know, these guys typically come from governors, mm-hmm. as governors.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the tension too. You know, they frequently get the benefit of that when they get there. There is therefore a little bit of bitterness that follows it, because they've run as outsiders. So that's an element of this as well.
Fred, you wanted to add
something? Congressional leadership meetings make excellent opportunities for press availabilities. They can sometimes come back to haunt you because of what the guys say when they go out under the portico once they've been in a congressional meeting. But, you know, we tried to regularly do either partisan or bipartisan congressional meetings. In many instances, they were an opportunity for the president to say something, you know, before the cameras, and depending upon what the issue of the day might be, and sort of, you know, surrounded there by the leadership of the Congress, and hopefully they would go out and say the right things when it was over. Yeah, we ended up having some deals, too. I remember distinctly, I think, the budget deal that got sort of finally negotiated in the with the congressional leadership, the expanded congressional leadership that included budget committee, chair and ranking, and finance committee. We had some guys that refused to go outside when the meeting was over, and there were some noticeable absences amongst the congressional leadership, and noticeable absences by folks who were going to have to make some, do some heavy lifting in that 1990. I'm sorry.
The
1990 budget act. So they kind of went out the back door instead of out in the Rose Garden, which that was scary. You take your chances. I was beginning to think of party discipline in the sense that Larry was saying about it, because basically we were powerless in our roles to, and I really think that the president may be powerless in his role to exercise any party discipline. But when you get down to nitty-gritty votes, as Max was describing, using the political party apparatus get where you needed to be was often used, and so it's, and I presume it's very much used today with Carl being the advisor to the president that he, in the role he has now with President Bush.
I'd like to pursue that last point a little bit with all of you, and that is that the House is becoming as safe as the Politburo in Havana these days. Only 39 seats are competitive, 39 seats, people won by 55% or less. They get their money outside the party. The interest groups are very strong. It brings deadlock frequently over the Patients' Bill of Rights, the Bankruptcy Bill of Rights, and other things. How do you maintain party discipline when you've got so much individualism going on, especially in the House of Representatives? Is it a problem?
Well, I want to underscore Larry's observations the last several years, maybe even longer, of the Clinton administration. I mean, I'm not sure the word discipline was ever used in a conversation. Okay. You know, or go up there and make them do. The convergence of interests, maybe, to get something done. But to discipline, you have to have the ability to enforce and punish. And you refer to people who are running ahead of the president. What are you going to do to me back home? You know, members looking, I was here before you, I'm going to be here after you. Okay. But to get to your question, sort of discipline, I'm not sure in the Democratic Party as it relates to the Congress. If we'd ever gone to the political apparatus back in the state, we'd have been killed. To a person, even our friends would say, what the hell are you doing? You don't do that. You'll come up and make an argument. They would have.
It seems that the times have changed since when Max was in compared to.
But I would say, and this gets, you know, I'm not sure the time, maybe for the congressional Republicans right now, you know, we're back to time, we haven't changed.
Let's go to Larry and Fred.
An anecdote, because I think it's useful, I think the three of us at least will remember this pretty graphically. In Clinton's first year, Richard Shelby, a Democrat, called Gore and said, come on up and talk to me about the BTU tax, which Gore proceeded to do. And they talked, and when they came out, the assembled Alabama press was outside the door, and Shelby announced his opposition to the BTU tax. Gore, I think justifiably angry, goes back to the White House and says, we can't allow this. So, I mean, there was I was in the Senate at the time, but I do know Roy Neal rather well, and the only thing they could think to do was to shut down. I think it was about 70 jobs that they went after the Huntsville Aerospace Center, and not only did Shelby subsequently change parties, He is now, I think, the most popular politician in the state of Alabama and is utterly unassailable. And you can trace his heroism to that moment. when you talk about party discipline, you should remember that incident, and so should virtually every president. If someone chooses to change parties or to oppose a president or to oppose party leadership, that's frequently an extraordinarily popular thing. And it hadn't hurt Jim Jeffords either.
Yeah, were you serving when Phil Brown?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about if you recall your relationship with him on the budget matters back in 1980?
Well, I wanted to mention what Larry just reminded me of. When you talk about when we had people like Ed Rollins and Atwater doing the political office, and we were at odds with them a lot of times because it was self-defeating in congressional relations to have them do a lot of that stuff, because I would remind them that, you know, we may not have Congressman so-and-so or Senator so-and-so on this vote, but there's always another vote. And if you alienate them on this vote, you alienate them on maybe the rest of the votes. So we were constantly, and President Ford, bless his heart, he understood that. And I recall one instance where Senator Pressler of, I think, South Dakota, he voted against us on a very important bill, and it was crucial. And one of our congressional relations staffers, who was from South Dakota, did an interview with the biggest paper in South Dakota on what a turncoat and scumbag and, you know, really bad interview about Senator Pressler. Mm. Well, I got a call from Senator Pressler, and
predictable.
Senator Pressler read me the interview, and it was quite over the top. So he said, "I want you to." He said, "I'm going to call."
That was an exciting conversation.
That I'm going to talk to President Ford about this, and I said, "Larry, let me talk to him." So I took the story in and I explained to President Ford what was going on there, and Pressler did go ahead and call him anyway. So the bottom end of the story is that the President Ford called me and said, "Max," he said, "I want you to fire the congressional relations person who gave that interview," and I did have to fire him. That was how that ended up, and Pressler was just totally off the wall.
Discipline worked the other way, went back to the White House.
Right. President Ford, that was kind of the end of the political office interfering in votes, and that really wasn't their job, I mean, to be like that, but they got a little bit aggressive. Congressman Graham, you mentioned. Well, that was Phil Graham, of course, being a Democrat, and when we started out with the first Reagan administration the first year, and the president said he was going to have three goals only, legislative goals, the tax cut, the budget cut, and restoring the military. And he worked on those three things, and everything else sort of was put on the back burner. And as we started getting into the drafting the budget, Dave Stockman had the lead on it from OMB. Phil Graham emerged as an ally. And, we were leery at first because we didn't know really where he was coming from. But he began to take up residence at the White House. He was down there constantly with Dave. And he became, him and some of his other colleagues like Kent Hance and Charlie Stenholm just became great allies and helped write the bill. And we couldn't have done it without him. Those boll weevils were obviously instrumental in ability to pass the tax cut and the budget cut that year.
You know, the president has an agenda. You mentioned three agenda items at this point with Reagan, but also the leaders on the Hill have an agenda. How did that work out when the leadership and the caucus had a slightly different agenda than the president? I mean, how did you work that out? Did you any comments on
just
it?
Just sort of to take that up and come back to you know, how the president was involved with Congress is in our couple of years, like I say, which were anomalous, I believe, there was a lot of communication in the main, I mean, constantly between the staff, of course, a day-to-day kind of thing, and excellent relationships, you know, particularly with the Senate leadership. But President Clinton's role was to be a sounding board. He never negotiated, as Larry says, and I have a funny story about the one time we teed him up to negotiate. But his role, we'd get down the leadership, the bipartisan leadership, a lot, more so, of course, the Democratic leadership, House, Senate. But the other thing that was essential would be just to bring in the various affected parties, the chairman, the extended budget groups, the Hispanic, the Black, the Asian caucus, the women. You know, he was constantly the sounding board, the listening person, the persuader. You know, the meetings would, you know, it'd be a lot of listening as the congressional groups would vent their frustrations or their desires. And so in my 2 years, President Clinton was instrumental as a sounding board and a general persuader. He would never engage in the specifics of the negotiation of the legislation, but just set out the broad themes, explain why, you know, he wanted to do what he wanted to do, and a lot of good listening going on. And it's funny what Fred said about the photo ops afterwards. You know, the meeting would be about half of it listening to the congressional side. The next quarter would be the administration putting forth its view. And the last quarter would always be, okay, what are we going to do when we go outside? And what are we going to say? Because that was absolutely critical, you know, and does anyone want to go through the back door? So, he was instrumental in this, although, you know, he never participated directly in negotiations. And just the one little story is that it was in August of 97, and we had finished the budget bill completely. You know, it was basically done, had been agreed to, and we had the votes, and everything was going along. And so I think as a matter of whimsy more than anything else, we said, you know, Mr. President, why don't you call Senator Lott and congratulate him? And by the way, there's this one issue that's still a little bit unresolved, and we'd like you to see if you can get it out of him. And so he said, sure, I'll give that a try. And it's such a small issue, I can't remember what it was. And so we, you know, he had his talking points, you know, and he gets on there, you know, does the whole script, congratulations, this is a great thing for America. And by the way, there's this one little item I got to bring up. And so he does, as he always did, brilliantly on his talking points. But he's sitting there going, mm-hmm. 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 And he covers the receiver, goes, you know, he's got a lot of good points. We go, okay, Mr. President, we'll take it from here.
Sure, Frank.
Yeah, John brought back up to go. I would like to revise and extend my remarks. President Carter did negotiate on the Panama Canal treaties a lot, face to face with members in the Oval Office, and line by line, and so he'd kill me if he ever saw a tape of this. I said he didn't negotiate.
Okay,
25 years ago.
Can I go back? Right.
That was early on.
Let's go to Chuck.
The question is the president's agenda versus the
leadership agenda.
The leadership agenda. Because I'm not so sure I can think of, you know, a leadership agenda. I mean, you've got their predispositions, their reactions. But really, it's the president through the budget, through the policy, you know, is laying out, here's what we want to do. We want to raise the minimum wage. We want patients' bill of rights. We want, you know, bang, bang, bang. And then it gets to the nature of the relationship between the two branches. You've got Congress reacting to that largely. And you know, in some
so the caucus meetings and conference meetings are meetings to react to the president rather than to establish
Maybe the closest thing to a congressional agenda or leadership agenda may be the contract that in recent memory. You know, there are issues that each side hopes they're going to get to over the course of time, and it is again affected by circumstance. I mean, is this year going to be a year for Medicare reform or not? Is this going to be a year for tort reform or not? Is this going to be some other issue then? But generally, the president sort of guides that, particularly particularly in his own political party, when, I mean, they sort of give him the leeway in that regard. I don't remember instances where they've really been that much in conflict.
Let's go to Max and Larry. And
when President Carter was elected, after he was elected, I went up to the Senate Policy Committee and staff director, and we had Senator Tower became chairman. He was a new chairman, and he instructed us to form a Senate domestic and foreign policy position paper on all the issues. And we worked off some of, took into consideration the program that President Carter put forth.
Our promises.
Promises. And then it was also, we could be more comprehensive because we weren't the administration. And we did that by we took the full spectrum from liberal to the center to the right wing of our Republicans in the Senate and put that together. And whenever a bill would come up, we would measure the position of the party on how they should vote or how we recommended they vote as based on that policy. So we did have an agenda, and we had enough support for it from all spectrums of the Republican Party and the Senate to hold pretty much party discipline on how they would vote. Of course, there would be deviations, but we would measure that against the Carter program. And it was an agenda. I don't think we ever formally presented it to you, but when there would be lobbying going on, we would present our side of the story, what we wanted.
Larry.
Yeah, to go back to something Chuck and Fred said, different things, but I think they're both really right. I mean, what Chuck's point is that it has always been, I think, and certainly through the years I was there, very difficult for Congress, for the leadership, to have a, quote, agenda. I mean, you've got so many different personalities, you've got so many different power nodes, et cetera. But the truth is that what Gingrich did, one of the reasons that everyone remembers it, is that it was kind of seminal in that regard. Now, bad or good, I don't want to say, because I think it has gotten a lot more credit for the 94 elections than it really deserves. I mean, there were a lot of elections where elements of the contract were used against Republican members and pretty effectively. But the point was to have, this is what you get if you get a Republican Congress. This is what we're for. It was a point of definition. And in that regard, it was extremely well received, and it became, I think, a standard against which subsequent leaderships tried to measure themselves, because I know when working for Daschle after, he always wanted one. Gephardt always wanted one, and I think the Republican leaders feel the same way. But that said, I mean, the one phrase that is used over and over and again about when you go up, they'll always say, you've got the bully pulpit. And that's the truth. Starting with the State of the Union and going through the budget at the beginning of every year, the president has the ability to set the agenda. He sets it to the American people. There are something, I can't remember how, it's either 40 million or something that watch the State of the Union. And there's really no way that Congress as an institution can compete with that in defining a clear set of legislative objectives. That just doesn't happen. That doesn't mean that throughout the rest of the year they don't chafe against what he wants, because they do. But
Well, yeah, when you say the party, I mean, you all define the party. Your old boss, Senator Humphrey, used to tell me there are four parties in the Senate. You know, the liberal Republicans, the liberal Democrats, the southern Democrats, and so forth. And there are at least six in the House. I mean, the gypsy moths, the boll weevils, you slice it and dice it any way you want to. And it's hard, you know, Jim Wright had an agenda on Nicaragua, and Phil, separate from the administration or from the speaker or anybody else. Phil Burton always had an agenda on national parks, you know, it was separate from anybody else's. But one of the things we did, and I found this book in my garage in my box about 3 months ago, I was moving, and it was pretty crude by the standards you all did. But we took, and I never told anybody on the Hill about this. In fact, I think it's the first time I've ever told anybody about it. But we took all the votes from the last two Congresses and analyzed them. Les Francis did it and put them on a computer, a Navy computer in Philadelphia. And we broke it out, because we didn't want it in the White House, we didn't want it to leak. So we broke out committee chairmen, subcommittee chairmen, freshmen, sophomores, people who, run 5 points ahead,
Westerners, Southerners, you know, North, anyway, sliced them, diced them any way you could. And when we were going to have a vote, we could run it and see about, you know, and it was a labor-saving device, because what we wanted to do was get the undecideds and work on them early, because if you knew somebody was going to vote this way or this way, don't waste your time on them. But what ended up happening with the thing was that we then refined it a little bit further. They said, well, that's about 2 years old, and so we'd get somebody to offer an amendment, essentially get a test vote. Knew it wasn't going to pass. Get it on the floor, go, and go talk to somebody in the rules committee and get, you know, get a modified rule or somebody. And so then you just take that vote count and look and see, you know, if you had 20 people you had to convince, or 40 or whatever, for when you put up your real legislation. And I know that's very crude compared to what you guys did, but well, I think we may have been the first ones to do it. But
that's very interesting. People in political science do this all the time. And Pat Griffin is on the record, you know, not confidentially, saying they never did that sort of thing. I'd like to hear from all of you.
Well,
you
I would never. That? I mean, Jim Wright or Tip O'Neill would have gone through the roof. Yes. I mean, they say we count the votes. We know. Had they known, we were sitting at the White House, you know, running a computer to see how their guys voted on an issue. They were just going through the roof on it. That's why I've never said anything about it.
But Chuck, what did you do? Call Condanus and find out what was going on the votes, or?
No, I mean, a combination, and yeah. I think it even changed over time, but you had to have your own vote count.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the whip was very good, and again, I think, so post-impeachment, the Democratic, congressional Democratic, especially House, it's to a large extent, too, and in interest with the president, sort of, we came much closer together than I think it had been. So we worked very closely. But you have to have your own vote count. We pushed a number of issues in the last couple of years, trade-related issues, that the leadership wasn't with us. And that's really when you get the importance of a staff. And again, we talk about, you know, good old-fashioned lobbying. People go up, talk to members. Where are you? What are you
lobbying against the membership? I mean, the leadership is lobbying against you.
Right. Did you have models like that? You know, databases where you were analyzing various factions of votes in a computerized way.
I kept a couple, but they were largely specific trade votes, because there have been enough trade votes.
Right, yeah.
You could see who's sort of going to be.
Larry, you're saying no.
No. What we typically did was do them by sort of thematic cluster. So you'd go back a certain number of years and look at, but you know, in the Senate, I had done most of the whip checks myself prior to my going down there, and you did them before me. I didn't have to do a computer. I had memorized the Democrats who were trouble, and blazoned in my memory. So that wasn't a problem. I mean, I think the House, I relied on Chuck, who was as good as any counter there was, and who also had enough institutional memory. You used to be able to remember the votes for most of these guys. So, I mean, we did have it all. We had available data. Didn't use it that much.
Yeah, right. Will,
when you get,
sorry, go ahead, Fred.
When you know, when you got eight abortion votes during the course of one appropriation cycle, you kind of figure out where the guys are.
You know where they are.
Where they're going to hang.
This was new stuff we were putting up.
Yeah.
Civil service reform, consumer protection. We had two new departments. We did energy and education, and there are no records for how people are going to vote on new departments, so you had to go back and get something similar.
We didn't do a computerized deal, but we sort of knew where people analyzed where they had been previously on issues.
Right.
And you know, like Frank said, you know, you sort of make sure your guys that are with you are where they are, and then you sort of work on those that truly fall into the category of being undecided. And, you know, our view, at least when we were there, was the only way you could get that answer was for one of us on the legislative staff to talk directly to the member themselves, which is why we spent 12, 15 hours a day up on Capitol Hill as opposed to back in the office in the East Wing.
We insisted
and
on
that. I kind of learned that from Max and from Will and others.
Right.
We insisted on any whip check had to be from, we would take the leadership's whip check first, and we'd comb that, and then we would do our own whip check. And if they came in and said he's yes or no or undecided, we insisted that that was not coming from the leadership or somebody told him, that they had talked to the member themselves and not to a staff person.
Right.
Because you get a lot of stuff, a lot of chaff from the staff people. You know, they're going to obfuscate or they're going to mislead
you. You're waiting on.
Finally, after you get all the yes and no's down and you get the undecided, you finally get a list of maybe on any vote, I would say a minimum of 10 or 20 and sometimes 30 that are undecided. And that's when you really go to work on them. And then you save the final, final undecided for the president to call. And you don't give him a list until you're down to the finite, you're only 24 hours away from the vote or 48 hours away from the vote. And when you give it to him, why, they can't be people that you don't have good information on. They got to be exactly accurate.
That's when you get in a position when you see that little newspaper article or that quote where such and such a senator says the White House has never talked to me on this issue, when you can respond with, no, 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 we know exactly who it was and this is who talked to you, because we force the conversations. And
Will, would you like to add to this?
I just think it probably is a little easier today to spot patterns than it was when Frank was there and when Max was there in the first Reagan term, given the proliferation of votes today. So you have a lot more votes and a lot more issues. You have a lot of the repetitive voting on similar issues. Just the volume is so much greater. you do, as Larry says, you know, after seeing this over and over again, you know where the alignments are, and then you try to spot where can you peel off. Who can be peeled off from an anticipated position, which is getting, I think it is getting trickier to do. And owing to the party realignments especially the southern constituencies that would send conservative Democrats to Washington, which now send almost completely send Republicans to Washington, that alters the business quite a bit, because those. We would always know they're going to be in the Senate five Republicans. We're not going to have on a fiscal issue or a foreign policy issue, but we're going to get 5 to 8 Southern Democrats, and that arithmetic was kind of at the key of a lot of these votes, where were the pluses and the minuses. But those trade-offs aren't there so much anymore, and that makes the discipline issue.
Then after the vote, you find out when you analyze it, who the liars are.
Well, occasionally.
Who are the liars and the big liars?
We had one. I remember during
one.
Well, one that sticks in my mind. In the Ford administration, we had a close vote, and Jack Marsh and I were working this guy. He was a Virginia Democrat, a Republican, and he had promised us on a stack of Bibles he was going to be with us, you know, so we put him down as yes, and the son of a gun voted against us. So Jack and I went, I said, you know, let's go up and see him. I just can't have that. So we went in there, and he told us, you know, the day of the vote, I got my card in the machine wrong. And he said, I made a mistake on the card. He said, I was really going to vote with you, but I just couldn't get the card in right. And that's the worst excuse I've ever had. If he just said, I changed my mind, I wouldn't have minded it.
Well, Max, how did you just with someone like Clifford Case, who we always counted on him to vote with us.
Who?
Senator Case from New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
But you couldn't do anything. I mean, he had labor support in New Jersey. What could you do for somebody like John Chafee?
Right.
They're going to vote the way they want.
Yeah.
Let's go to Jim and Dick, if you have a question, too. Let's move. To you two, Jim.
No, I was just, this is a slight change of subject. We've been talking about dealing with the members directly. And with the leadership, what about the congressional staff dealing with those people? For what? Was it good? Was it not? What was the experience? Because over the years you've been there, there's been quite a growth in committee personal staff. And of course, we have some veterans here on the staff.
Well, I mean, the Senate, well, the both bodies are really run by the committees when it comes down to it. So it's really committee staff, which is where the interplay is. And
you know, given the dominance of the money committees, the Ways and Means, the, you know, in obviously Commerce and House, and Appropriations and Finance, that's where the, you know, the communication and the beyond the leadership. I mean, clearly everything goes through the front door of the leadership, or you're just doing yourself a world of hurt. And again, just you know, I think the relationships that, you know, in the Senate side have been always during my tenure particularly good. But it was critical to work with the committees of jurisdiction, because at the end of the day, these guys have got to move it through committee. They've got to get it out of committee. They've got to bring it to the floor. That's your first test votes. You know, that's sort of where it all begins. And so communication with committee staff. Every week we would attend the leadership-sponsored staff directors meetings. And so that was a Monday meeting where, you know, it's sort of interesting where you learned a lot, but also, you know, it's here, why don't you take this problem? You know? That was really critical, is the communication with this at the staff director level.
And the leadership staff.
Leadership staff. It starts with leadership.
Divide this. Yeah. I think on the, when you're constructing legislative strategy, and you definitely have to work with the staff. The staff directors, I mean, those people write the bills. But when you're dealing in votes, you got to talk to a member. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're trying to figure out where a guy's going to be or a woman's going to be, you got to talk to the member, because the staff will almost, you very frequently get misdirected by the staff.
That's if you had only four spots on the speed dial on the phone, it'd be the four leadership aides, chief of staff to the House Senate DNR. No, you know, I mean, you got to work with the other people, and we did an awful lot of briefings, and even the House and Senate deputies would go to other meetings with the legislative directors. So there's an awful lot of that. But if there are four people, you're going to, you know, four calls you're going to make, those I think are the four.
What about working with interest groups? NAFTA had a coalition building effort by Wexler, and Wexler was doing it for the president, paid by others. Did you go to heads of interest groups to put pressure upon people on the Hill to get your agenda through, ever?
Big stuff like that. We had fast track for NAFTA during my tenure, and there was a huge outside effort. Most of it was sort of conducted by the folks in public liaison in conjunction.
But not by you.
No. Now, there were times when we participated in their efforts, i.e., you know, Fred, you need to come talk to these guys because they need to kind of know what you can tell them of the dynamics, what's going on, almost sort of pep rally kind of a deal. We also got, we on the other hand, from the legislative side, got the benefit of their whip counts because that fed into our decision making process and sort of the double check on whether or not we had the right, we were moving in the right direction.
Max, yeah, Max, you wanted to add.
Well, the first year of the Reagan administration, when the president announced his program for budget reduction and tax cut, the business community formed a very strong, led by the Chamber of Commerce, I believe, and they asked us to come over and inaugurate the first meeting and speak to them, and public liaison carried the ball after that. But they wanted to be in some of the congressional relations meetings because they didn't want to feel like they were on the fringes or the edges. So we included some of their top lobbyists in our deliberations and our meetings. And I would say they were very instrumental in passing those programs. That was an unusual circumstance, that one. And on each of the bills, if there is a group out there that can help you, you're naturally going to gravitate toward them, or they're going to gravitate towards you. So we made as much use of the interest groups as we could.
Frank, what about the situation with the National Education Association and Mr. Carter? It is reported that all of the NEA members at the convention voted for him and that he pushed the creation of the Department of Energy with their help. Is that so? They were up in front working on this, like the energy bill this time. People got together before it went to the Hill. I mean, that's what's reported. Was that common? And did you work with that?
Well, I did a lot of delegate selection in 16, 17 states. And I chose people that had helped us in the primaries. And oftentimes it was the communication workers, because they could work the phones, and the teachers, because they could talk on the phones, or, you know, have shoe leather. And so I think we did have a disproportionate amount of education NAA delegates at the convention, but we also had a lot of communication workers and UAW workers. UAW was very, very helpful to us in Iowa and Florida, and against in North Carolina against George Wallace. But I don't know that we made any promises to create a Department of Education.
That was what was reported. Generally.
Maybe true. I don't know. I'm not aware.
Well, the issue here is not the promise, but did you work with them? This interest group.
Yeah, we. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We worked with them, and we worked with others. We worked with, you know, some of the international unions, you know, and their members of the so-called Chrysler bailout. It was a loan guarantee. We went into every district. We had a Monroe shock absorber plant, and had 60, you know, workers there. And worked it backwards through the members, and a lot of those were in the South, where people just didn't necessarily want to, you know, weren't going to vote for it. But the one that impressed me, though, I worked as a private business lobbyist on NAFTA because my chairman wanted me to. And after I saw what the Business Roundtable and the chamber did, and the money they were spending, and the phones, and the poll, and it scared me to death. Yeah. I said, my gosh, that is a powerful, powerful force. I mean, when you have the chairman of Motorola, the chairman of Caterpillar, Amoco, talking about the five biggest businesses in Illinois, you know, call a member and say, we want your vote. That's powerful stuff.
It's a legal line, though. I think I don't know when it,
yes,
you know, became implemented, but all administrations follow it, and people in legislative affairs are aware. You can't lobby someone to go lobby the Congress. So you can your public liaison will hold a meeting, and you can come in, and you'll talk about the status and how it's looking, but you won't find someone sitting there and saying, and we have a problem with Congressman Smith. You guys go up and get us Smith. It just, you know, the information's available, but that line is observed very, very diligently.
Dick, do you have a question that you would like?
Yeah, my impression is that when Ann Wexler took over public liaison in the Carter administration, that was changed. I'd just like to get the story.
That was changed where we could lobby people to lobby people?
That it was made much more of a pointed, targeted operation.
Oh, that's true.
From the lobby to go after the member.
That she did grassroots or top roots, the leaders of these groups, to then go after the members.
Yeah. It wasn't veiled at all. Now, for reasons I've never understood, no other administration seems to have followed that Wexler formula.
No one has beaten it as badly.
I think public liaison, it's a whole different branch of the operation, can vary in that. And even the heads of public liaison that I saw, some of them, they're almost captives of the interests, you know. It's the teachers or, you know, whomever. Okay, how many White House tours can they get? So public liaison comes to you as an advocate for them. And again, some of the trade votes, because that's where a lot of these coalitions come together in the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. Public liaison was very effective in reaching out, getting those folks, and bringing them to meetings and mobilizing them. Maybe not to the extent of that Ann did, and it's probably unique, but I think all too frequently public liaison is a captive of the groups.
However, if I may want to challenge you a bit and follow up on this, you have all talked about having an influence on where the president goes. And the president goes above the heads of Congress sometimes, as Mr. George W. Bush did on his first tax cut in Montana, Louisiana, to put pressure on those members through those visits. Right. How involved have you been in structuring where the president goes to put pressure on members that seem to be wavering on an issue? Will?
I don't know. I think that's a relatively new phenomenon. And I don't I recall, you know, in the 86 election, the president's political schedule included a lot of stops in states where there were competitive races. But I don't recall any trips that were based on giving talks, making points in a constituency. That was not. No. You know, that was before the day now of the television campaigns that the groups are running. I mean, it's no longer just special interest groups organizing mail or postcards or shutting down congressional switchboards. Now it's television stations in Washington are just it's a regular ongoing feature of advocacy advertising from this or that group. So it has changed. The communications environment is quite different.
Right. Let's move.
We sometimes use the president's travel to give him an opportunity to collar somebody in Congress that might have been wavering on an issue, or we weren't sure where they were going to be, and so we put them on the airplane with the president for the purpose of him having a chance to talk to them directly. You know, my office participated regularly in the weekly scheduling meetings that took place within the White House apparatus for the purpose of sort of deciding where the president was going to go. And then ultimately that bubbled back up to the senior staff, and ultimately the decisions, you know, made by chief. But I distinctly remember a vote. It was a Caribbean Basin Initiative. Which was going on in the middle of tax reform in 1986, and the Finance Committee had to stop and deal with CBI for some reason. And the senator then from California, Matsunaga, was that who it was? Senator Matsunaga. Yeah. Wasn't he from California? Hawaii. Hightower. We couldn't figure out where he was on the vote. And I mean, it was like normally he sort of followed along whatever Senator Benson did, and we knew we had something that was a tie. And we finally learned that the senator wanted to ride on Air Force One and had never had a chance to do that. So we popped him on with President Reagan. They rode to California. The guy came back and voted right. I mean, you know. And they didn't. I don't even know who they talked to in that trip out. We occasionally use it in that fashion, as opposed to popping in and talking in your territory.
Let's move to the after Frank to the end of the table for some questions.
I'll do one quick one. You talk about, and I don't think you can ever do discipline, but you can build up a little goodwill. And I'm sure everyone around the table ran a midterm election operation, and we ran it out of our shop. I had two of my deputies who. And we used all the surrogates, used all the cabinet, you know, first family, vice president, and so forth. We did the scheduling and the airplanes. And that, you know, I think we did maybe 200 trips, you know, in the midterm. And we don't want it for us, Mr. or Mrs. Member. We want it for you. We want to reelect you.
Right.
Because we want to have you. But you build up some goodwill there, and it also gives you a chance to talk. We always had had one of my staff, usually, you know, always had a member of my staff on the hops around. So it gives you a chance to talk to people. And the vice president was a good fundraiser. First lady was a good fundraiser. The president, you know, used him for Senate races, not many House races. But.
You have the town meeting so-called. Mm-hmm. Carter would go around the country. This wasn't ostensibly a public liaison, but there were a lot of issues he would discuss or focus on in these meetings.
Yeah.
Did you have something to do with the use of that?
Well, I had something to do with, I mean, the fact that we had the first one on Yazoo Mississippi wasn't a coincidence that that's what Sonny Montgomery is, his hometown. But you ask people to ride, you know, get the members to ride with you and include them in and so forth. And frequently, the members were impressed by sitting and watching the press to, you know, take these questions like a talk show host and, you know, bounce them around and talk knowledgeable about these issues. And that benefited you some. But the thing I'm talking about, Jim, is separate, distinct from that.
Yeah.
Running a midterm election campaign. We are available. We've got people available to go with you, to make a speech with you, to do whatever, announce a grant or whatever.
Steve Wayne, you have a question.
Yeah, I have two questions. One, a quick question. When you got involved in voting, did you get involved in the committee voting to send the bill out, or did you wait till it got to the floor?
Sometimes. Frequently had to, especially when it was tight and important.
More likely, your deputies and the specials would be assigned to a committee, would be working that committee. And so they'd be there, they'd be going to the markups and, they're only on relatively rare occasions, close vote, big issue, where I think.
Like close votes on nominations, CI director,
yeah. Well, it's
involved in, or, yeah, or Supreme Court nominations. Or.
It's always easier to change it in committee, to start out right, than waiting and trying to change it on the floor, which is pretty hopeless. So we would have people in the committee meetings, subcommittee meetings, markup. That was just routine to do that.
Actually, following up on that question, to what degree were you focused on procedural votes? Sometimes the procedural votes are so critical to structuring the way a bill is going to be considered, but explaining that to the public, why this rule is really critical, is obviously difficult. So, you know, the tension between using the bully pulpit and the resources of the presidency versus trying to influence an arcane matter about the structure of legislation, how do you handle that?
Well, one way you handle it is when the Rules Committee was critical to us in the House, because if you don't get the right kind of rule, you cannot get the right kind of vote. So we were very deeply involved in the drafting of the rule and trying to lobby for the right kind of rule. So when it came to the floor, it would be the issue would be presented in a way that we wanted it to be presented. If you'd let the Rules Committee go their own way, well, you might get a rule that you couldn't change, or you couldn't defeat, or you couldn't deal with on the floor.
Now, Max, the LBJ tapes, they're wonderful to listen to. We've all listened to them. He was recorded calling the chairman, Judge Smith, you know,
right,
and calling and saying, "Now, I realize that so-and-so and so-and-so are doing this and that." Did you have presidents, all of you, that did that, that got down to that level inside the Rules Committee?
Well, Trent Lott, that's where he got his start, was a staff director for the House Rules Committee. And he was a born politician, even when he was a very young man. And I can't remember any of the presidents I worked for calling him. Of course, they would call Judge Smith, but Trent was critical in knowing where the members of the Rules Committee were on both sides of the aisle. And we always tried to work through Trent and the Republicans on the committee.
Steve, you had a second question. We'll go to Frank. But
yes, I just wanted to know the extent to which your lobbying it extended to scheduling the bills. I mean, did you defer to the leadership on that, or did you try to influence when they brought things up and how they moved it along?
Well, timing is frequently critical. I mean, we were engaged. I think most of us were very engaged in the timing, scheduling of major issues, because in the ebb and flow of events, so many other things would affect the outcomes of those votes. So sometimes more time would be needed to give emphasis to the president's position, give an opportunity for a few more public statements and appearances. Sometimes you instinctively knew time was on the side of the opposition, and a quicker vote was in order. So.
Let's get this over with.
Right. And that goes back to Eric's question, too. The way you did that many times in the Super Rules Committee.
because if you didn't have a rule, it wasn't going to the floor. But you, we, at least when I was there, you contacted the chairman of the Rules Committee at your own peril because it's a leadership committee. The speaker put him on there, his people. But we did contact him, but it would oftentimes be when the speaker says, I can't do any more will than you call. You won't do it for me. And it happened to be Pepper, Florida, I believe, was chairman. Delaney first, and then Pepper, and then Claude Pepper.
We did, oh, I'm sorry. We did engage in some, I guess, sort of another aspect of the rules process. I'll make this comment, first of all, about the Senate, since I'm a creature of the Senate. The Senate has no rules, so it doesn't make any difference. We were frequently involved, however, and this was a different sort of a scheduling issue. When we had to veto a number of bills during the Bush administration, you know, the guys and gals always ask us, make sure you give us the clearest signal you can of what you're going to do before we get ready to walk the plank. And don't, you know, don't pull the, cut the limb off from under us. And so we did a lot of work with the leadership in terms of, you know, letting the House do the veto sustain this time, letting the Senate do the veto. If you look back over, you'll notice that it sort of went back and forth, so the same guys didn't have to walk the plank. That was a part of our effort in terms of trying to coordinate that with the leadership staff. It's a little bit of a scheduling issue there.
I just emphasize that you know, the work through the leadership is the critical thing, and since, you know, it's the prerogative of the leader to really handle the scheduling, it was always through the leadership office that we would do that. And you know, I agree, in the House, the Rules Committee really through the leader sets the agenda, and so one would have to defer to that. But in the Senate, where, you know, there's either changing rules, no rules, or a lot of rules, depending on the day. You know, the leadership staff on both sides is really amazingly adept at exploiting all the procedural aspects of either slowing something down or speeding something up. And we would defer to these people who are just unbelievably good at that to help us structure the timing and the impediment of various, various pieces of legislation. But you really turn to the procedural experts on the floor who really know how to drive it.
If we really want to get into the procedural minutiae, for purpose only for the historical record here, you even get to the point of negotiating when a bill is going to be sent to the president, or when a veto message is going to come down.
Right.
You say, you know, he's going out of town. You better get it down here tomorrow, or else you know, he's going to be in Africa. We're not going to send a messenger on a plane to Africa to get this signed.
But we've done that.
Oh, and
we had to send
that,
Lisa Cantupas to, didn't we send her to Asia because to sign a continuing resolution? The government would have shut down. I think she got lost in Europe too, if I remember.
But don't send us a veto message. Don't send us a veto bill right now. Give us a little bit of time. And so you get into that really deep stuff.
It's the one time the president can control something to do with legislation is when he vetoes a bill.
John, you have a question.
Yes, it's
John Gilmore.
As a bill is working its way through Congress, the White House will often issue veto threats, saying if the bill is presented to the president in its current form, we would recommend that it be vetoed. Or if a certain amendment is adopted, we would recommend that it be vetoed. I'm wondering how much ambiguity there is about the president's position when a veto threat is issued, and whether or not it's possible to use ambiguity or uncertainty about the president's position to to move Congress. And maybe you have I'd be interested in any particular story.
Let's go with Larry first.
Just real fast. This is a wonderful subject of arcane science, I think. This really is. Because we would struggle over the degree of veto threat, whether it was at agency level, senior advisor. I mean, I can't remember how many gradations we had, but at least four. And we would, you know, internally there
would
could
recommend
be,
and would strongly recommend.
Oh yeah, the wording of that one sentence in the SAP. But I was never shut. I must say, when I was up there myself, I would scan the SAPs, and if there was a veto threat in there, I'd weigh it in my own mind about whether he'd do it. But I never paid that much attention to the language of it. But when we were down, we would go through enormous intellectual gyrations to try to figure out what the right phrasing was. I've never been sure myself how much. In a props, they look at it closely, because
But for the most part, I always treated it as crap when I was up there.
But you do have the hierarchy, and I think all administrations probably fall into the same rules, and maybe it comes through the institutional part. You know, to say in a SAP, the president will veto this bill. I mean, at that point, I mean, our rule was he has had to have made some public statement beforehand. I mean, he's already out there, the president will.
So,
and then you know, you've
that's
got,
the least frequently used.
So, you're very careful when you use that, because once you've done it, then you've given about 25 or 30 people a free vote.
Yeah. But I found that
more than that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Maybe 40 people a free vote once you ever use that.
Yeah. My work in the House, I mean, Dave Barnier took me aside and he said, you know, when you, again, this is sort of impeachment, post-impeachment, we're all together. When you say the veto word, you know, we're going to go out and bust our ass to make sure you've got the 145, 50 votes. So don't throw that around frivolously. Mm-hmm. Because we take that seriously, and we'll do everything. And I think in the 8 years, Clinton administration lost one vetoed bill. Now, that there's an iterative process, too. I mean, if you're not going to get the votes, well, maybe you don't want to veto.
And there's also the statement of administrative policy, the SAPs, and Larry mentioned it, you mentioned it. I'm doing a little study on this, and I find that Carter was the first one to use a SAP, and I want to find out later whether that's true or not. There's degrees of threat in SAPs.
Right.
It's not vetoes. We want $150 million for this particular program. Were you all involved in writing SAPs?
We're involved, certainly in the degree of veto threat, But usually OMB wrote the substance.
Right.
And then sometimes they would come to us, at least when I was there, and we would alter them occasionally depending on our assessment.
And Max, before that, there weren't statements of administrative policy, but what did you use? Wasn't that term, SAPs.
I think that President Ford is a good example. He vetoed 62 bills, and we sustained 56 of them. And I can't ever recall one veto threat that he made that he didn't follow through on. He did not, and I think that was the reason was that he came from the Hill, and he was of the old school of Mike Mansfield and Sam Rayburn and Carl Albert, that you did not make veto threats idly. If you sent a veto signal up there, it was going to be vetoed. There was no hanky-panky about degree of veto.
Right.
And he appreciated that, and he was very, very careful about making a veto threat, even if it was $10 million, only $10 million over the budget. And he said he would veto it, and they would cut it to $5 million. He still would veto it, but he was not going to be accused by the leadership of crying wolf on vetoes.
Our next high, and I think most of us had things, our sort of second degree beyond the president himself saying it was senior advisors would recommend veto, and you always gave yourself a little out, which is, well, the president said he didn't like what his senior advisor said, and so, and then it sort of went down by gradation. You might have a couple of cabinet secretaries would recommend veto, and even a department.
But again, I think on the Hill, if you didn't see presidential veto, you know, those lower ones, you knew those were negotiable.
They were negotiable. That's exactly what it was saying.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll continue this discussion in the hallway where a lot of more information is exchanged.
We'll break for about 15 minutes. I think we're going to try to get a group photograph made, and then we'll come back for the next session again in about 15 minutes.
Thank you very much.
So pretty.